This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon and welcome to another day of the Country Hour across Western Australia. I'm Kate Forrester and it's great to have you with me this Friday, which actually also happens to be National Agricultural Day. So to those of you that celebrate, I hope you're having a great day. And if you're tuning in through the ABC Listen app this afternoon, well, you're in the right place if you're not a cricket fan. But if cricket is more your thing, don't forget you can switch over to your radio for all that live action. And if you do change over, you're still going to get a little bit of the Country Hour because Tara de Landgraft will be presenting a shorter version of the program during their lunch break. But coming up on this program, a little later on, I will be speaking with Australian Wool Innovation because they've teamed up with Meat and Livestock Australia, MLA, to release new data showing a boost in confidence across the sheep industry. And according to the producers surveyed, strong market prices are what are driving optimism at the moment, and many producers, according to this data, are planning to rebuild and expand their flocks as we head into the new year. So I'll have all those details a little later on in the hour. Thanks for keeping me company today. It is 12:06 on the Country Hour. And to kick things off, Western Australia is officially set to harvest a record grain crop of 26.6 million tonne. Now, that's according to the latest Grain Industry Association of WA crop report, which has been released today, so it's hot off the press. Report author Michael Lamont says there will be more record tonnages in 3 out of 4 port zones too.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt, no doubt whatsoever, and it's been obvious for a while. The question is how much of a record it will be, really. Yeah, I mean, there is, like, you know, the Esperance, you're right, Tara. I mean, the Esperance port zone is getting close to halfway. You know, it'll easily be a record there of 4.5 million tonnes or more. Geraldton, same. Geraldton was, of course, much later starting than normal due to the beautiful finish they had, which has fueled massive tonnes up there. So they're on track for about a record by away, 4.5 million probably total tonnes. And the Albany port zone, which is the other one that's been quite a star performer again this year, is, you know, they've hardly got, I mean, they're harvesting out in those eastern areas, East Albany port zone, but the West Albany has virtually not started. So the prediction, I mean, you know, we know that there's been about 20% more crop area in the Albany port zone since 22, the previous record. Just on that basis alone, that'll bring another million tonnes. So, you know, it's pretty likely that Albany will be up around 6.5 million tonnes. The previous record in 22, we had it 26, but we now know with more advanced analytics and whatever that we've got, it was probably closer to 25.4. So there's no question we're going to exceed that. We've got 26.5 at the moment. We could have easily gone higher. The only thing is that in the central regions where you're in the Kwinana port zones, the Kwinana northeast, the Midlands is just insanely good. The perimeter of the northeast is very good. The low rainfall areas, the low rainfall perimeter, Bonnie Rock, all that north of Meriden, excluding sort of that Makabeni sort of area, and out right out far east, Southern Cross, is very good. But there is big licks of country in the central regions on the border of the Kwinana South and the northeast where it's not so good. There's growers there. You know, there's certainly some growers that have had a terrible year, and quite a lot of growers probably only average due to a combination of lack of grain in the growing season, later start, and then frost. So, you know, it's a difficult one to try and put a finger on, but when you've got three of your zones going to definitely hit records and then portions of the other big Kwinana zones going very well, you know, we're definitely on track for a record. No question about it.
Mm. And you mentioned some of that Kwinana region, Michael, and we know that in the last 2 weeks there have been a number of significant storms that have gone through, especially the eastern parts of the Kwinana zone. Some of the videos and photos that came through to us on the Country Hour of hail around Southern Cross this week, following closely behind hail 2 weeks ago. I mean, has that, have you seen a difference in the numbers in that part of the region?
Oh, well, for individual growers, it's significant. There's no, yeah, of course. The cells, again, were quite isolated and intense, they weren't huge areas. They're quite intense, and for certain growers, very significant. But overall, no, you know, there's too many tons to make up the difference. So, you know, I don't really have a figure on what the grain loss might have been, but no, it's not going to have a material impact on the total tons, really.
Mm. And as you say, 3 out of 4 of the port zones looking at breaking their previous records. If we break it down into different commodity types, where have you sort of seen that real growth in terms of tonnages that you are expecting to get to this point?
Well, the barley area is one of the largest areas planted ever, and the barley has gone very well everywhere. So the barley, you know, will exceed the 22 production year of barley of around 6 million tonne by about over a million, maybe a million and a half, due in part to increased area, but also it's just had a dream run, the barley. The canola, interestingly, there's only about 2 million hectares of canola, so that was less than 22, but there's certainly going to be well over 4 million tonnes. So a state average of 2 is pretty incredible when you consider a lot of that is in the low rainfall areas. But now the headers are in, the canola yields are certainly well above what was expected. Oats is an interesting one. Oats, there was quite a tick up in oat area again this year. So the year-on-year increase is about 15% the last few years. And the oats, you know, they will probably come in around about a million tonne. You know, oats are contributing, you know, double what they did in 22 in total tonnes across the state. The wheat's the interesting one, is that wheat probably won't be a record, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Less wheat area from 22. Certainly more in the Geraldton port zone than in 22 because of the late start. You know, the growers ditched lupins and canola to some extent, and there wasn't the fallow. So reduced area, but still, you know, 3.5 million tonnes is a pretty incredible result for up there. It's where probably the two Kanana zones is where the wheat probably won't come in, you know, at record levels. So the wheat tons are probably, they're still going to be good, you know, 13 million, which is a lot, but it's the Kanana zones, particularly the central areas, that aren't going to produce sort of record levels. You know, that's the estimate at the moment.
Giwa Crop Report author Michael Lamond speaking to Tara DeLandgraaf. 12 past 12. And as you just heard, there's record tonnages expected for Albany, Geraldton and Esperance port zones. And the rate at which farmers can harvest these days means much of that grain has been coming in very fast, as you can imagine. The state's main grain handler, CBH, says there have been some teething issues, but Esperance Zone General Manager Paul Channon is confident that they have the space for the massive grain haul.
During the week, our receivables got to around 858,000 for the zone. So that's it's another great effort there. And, we saw, consecutive days of over 100,000. And it was only a couple of days ago that we broke our zone record at 114,413. So good result all around.
So a zone record, individual sites breaking records left, right and centre as well?
Absolutely. So Shark Lake's record's been broken twice. Mungolan Ups has been broken twice. Chadwick's achieved a new record. And also yesterday Mount Madden broke their record as well. So there's a few new numbers on the page today.
Now, that's obviously great news for growers who are being able to get that crop off and some big tons coming in terms of what that's meant for actually putting this grain somewhere. Paul, are you having a few issues in terms of finding somewhere to fit it?
Well, it's a good question, and I guess it's if you go to Chadwick, it's very evident that things are, you know, it's been a busy time at Chadwick and it's looking quite full. Through the zone, we have that captured fleet of trucks that have been working really well for us and moving grain around through the lakes predominantly and out near grass patch. So if we bring it back to the port precinct right now, so we're really busy at making some more room at Chadwick. Like I mentioned over the last couple of weeks, the stem for us is really healthy, which is good. So Now with some of the other commodities starting to taper off, such as the canola and barley, it'll give us more options across, particularly around the port precinct and down into the terminal. So it is busy. It is quite full, but right now the team are working extremely hard to make some extra grid capacity at Chadwick, and we'll continue to do that over the next few days while this weather hangs around, so that when we open up again, it gives us a few more options. So yes, it's tight. The team is working extremely hard. We've got a good stem to support us. And probably the other key point, we sent a message out during the week about utilising Shark Lake, and that was great to see growers do that. And all it's around is, for us, it's operational efficiency, making sure that we have good grid capacity when the wheat really comes on.
Is it, or was it quite fortuitous that the rain happened when it did, so that things could slow down, so you could get some grain out and free up some space?
I mean, while rain is a hassle and it slows everything down, it does give us the opportunity to jump in there and make some, or to make the most of a bad situation, I guess you could say. So no one likes to see the rain. We'll take the few days to do what we can around Chadwick and yeah, and then be ready for the wheat obviously to come in, which no doubt it'll come in nice and quick like it has done over the past few weeks.
The forecast for the zone was big, and it seems it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. But could you have imagined it to have all come in to be almost 50%, you know, middle to tail end of November?
It's a good question. I think what we've seen this year, the speed that the crop can come in now definitely challenges us. It's something that we'll need to look at when we do our post-harvest review, work out where we can get some upside. I think some of the improvements we've made this year have really helped with some of the throughput, but I still think there's some good opportunities that we can learn from for this year and take into hopefully a similar crop next year.
CBH Esperance Zone General Manager Paul Channon, he was speaking to Tara DeLandgraft. Well, in other grains news, Grains Australia hopes a project to identify new export opportunities for canola meal will help farmers capitalise on the changing market for the oil seed. Growing demand for canola oil, particularly in the sustainable aviation sector, means there's a projected increased supply of its byproduct, canola meal. Currently, the canola meal that's produced in Australia is almost exclusively consumed domestically by the livestock sector. But Grains Australia CEO Richard Simonitis says there could be an untapped market for canola producers overseas.
We know growers are growing a lot of canola these days and it's working well for them. We're also seeing the demand in Australia domestically for canola oil is strong. You know, an important part of the economics is the value of the meal as a component of the crush margin. So the project is really anticipating an increase in demand, and that'll sort of oversaturate the domestic market with meals. So it's really a case of getting up into the market and understanding the demand side, but also trying to stimulate the demand by providing some technical support about where canola can be adopted into rations in Asia.
Because I suppose canola meal, it is a byproduct, but it's a very valuable byproduct as well, especially for the livestock sector.
Yeah, that's right. Works especially well in dairy. So, you know, we've included New Zealand in the scope of this. There's an opportunity for our East Coast crushers perhaps to get meal across into New Zealand dairy. You know, it stacks up really well against other proteins like soybean meal and DDGs, for example, and particularly good in dairy because, you know, canola meal goes into bypass protein, which makes it a more directly available source of protein for the animal. And, you know, in a dairy application, you'll see the results in the bucket the next day.
What sort of amount of canola meal is being produced in Australia at the moment, Richard?
At the moment, you know, it's about 600,000 to 700,000 tonnes a year. But we're seeing the crushers are investing you know, putting in additional lines, improving processes to become more efficient and slowly growing the volume. But then, of course, you know, there's anticipation around the sustainable aviation fuel and even the low carbon fuels initiatives that are coming through. So we'd expect there to be some sort of response on the supply side there, you know, with our crushers stepping in to soak up that extra demand.
That was Grains Australia CEO Richard Simonitis speaking with Tara DeLandgraft.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
That's right. You can keep me company this afternoon on the ABC Listen app. If you're tuning in that way, just text in, as you heard there, on 0448 922 604 if you've got any thoughts to share. But to some big beef trade news out of America this morning now. US President Donald Trump has removed the 40% tariff on Brazilian beef. Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends says it could result in a drop in prices locally.
I think this does put a dampener potentially on prices moving forward, but just the short term, Angus. So I think that we'll likely see Brazil beef fill its allocation by late January, early February. And once that's filled, I think the market then comes back and looks for Australian beef to fill the void. So it may see a short-term weakness, but overall the fundamentals remain very strong for next year for cow.
What impact had the tariff on Brazilian beef been having on markets?
Well, what we saw, you know, given that they had the extraordinary duty of 50% plus 26.4%, the flow out of Brazil had really come to a standstill or a trickle, Angus, over the last 6 months. So, you know, there was a 10% reduction only last week, but this further reduction will have a far greater impact and therefore see the flows back into America and probably at the expense of China when it comes to Brazilian beef.
What does that mean for demand out of China for Australian beef?
I think that continues to be in good shape and strong. We're helped by the fact that US beef doesn't go to China, but this then adds further to that and we're likely to see further demand for Australian beef out of China.
And in terms of Brazilian beef and beef into America, we're really talking about hamburger beef, hamburger meat?
Yes, we are. And I think this is what highlights to me some of the shortcomings of the Argentinian announcement was that the type of beef out of Argentina is very different to Brazil. And it is Brazilian lean beef that America requires, whereas the Argentinian beef is more of a higher quality from a Bos Taurus base versus a Bos Indicus. So I think for America's needs and the consumer, this actually is going to probably have a much greater impact than the Argentinian announcement 6 weeks ago.
So just returning to the Australian context, as you said earlier, you expect short-term downside, but you're still very positive about the longer term?
I believe so. And look, as we move into a rebuild, Australia does, and in particular Southern Australia, I think that the end of the day, Angus, the numbers are so tight out there in Southern Australia that I think even this will not stop the lift in cattle prices and cow prices. But in the short term, there could be a little bit of a correction here. But I think as we get into the Christmas period and post for that February, March arrival in America, I think prices start to strengthen again.
That was Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends speaking with Angus Verley. 24 past 12. A renewable energy advocacy group has released a handbook to help communities benefit from renewable projects in their regions. The publication is called Collaborating for a Fair Energy Shift, a Handbook for Communities, and it's been authored by the Community Power Agency. Project manager Marie Lakey says communities need better support in the transition to wind and solar.
The aim of the handbook is to support communities in navigating the energy shift and secure better outcomes for their regions. It offers really practical strategies and tools and case studies on ways that communities can collaborate towards better outcomes. And part of that is having some key sections on topics that keep on coming up in our work, or really common themes that we see for communities. So things like having good outcomes for biodiversity, finding opportunities to secure local jobs, avoiding negative impacts on housing affordability or availability, best practice engagement from developers, and a whole bunch of these are really elucidated with some strategies and some case studies to bring them to life.
Do you think the handbook will, in some part at least, win over or convince communities or individuals who either don't support the transition or who aren't sure where to land on it?
I'm sure this will depend a lot on individual people and their context. The handbook really aims to be very proactive, but also sensitive to the big change that's happening. But I also know that there's going to be different feelings that it would bring up when you feel like you're just sort of in the midst of this big, big change. But for those who are curious about constructively working with others towards better outcomes, we hope that they find it useful and that it's a place to get started.
And the handbook talks about communities playing a more active role in the development of renewable energy projects in their region. But in many cases, there are people and groups, and where I am in Western Victoria particularly, they don't just not want a more active role, they don't want a role at all, do they?
I think that that's a really good point. A lot of communities are just feeling overwhelmed with the fact that these projects are even happening, and they're happening in their backyard. And I'm sure that there's many people that would rather that things just stay the same and they don't have to sort of be faced with this big change. One of the things that I would say is that many communities are already actively getting engaged and working in this space. And a really good example, I think, is some of the work that's been led in the Wimmera region. So the Wimmera Southern Mallee Development Regional Energy Collaboration was one where, community representatives came together with industry partners to try and secure some real commitments from industry for how they could work better with communities and deliver on things that mattered. I think also for those people that really don't want to see change happening, one of the challenging parts of this is that we have a really aging energy system. There's a whole bunch of old coal plants that are failing across the country. And unfortunately, new energy is needed because we're consuming more than we ever have before. And so with renewable energy being the cheapest form of new energy, it makes sense that we're going to need to build some new assets. But having a say in what they look like, how they're developed, and making sure that they meet the needs of local communities is something that we hope this handbook can help people to lead on.
And is it difficult, though, for people to know who to believe? Because just one example you mentioned there, renewables being the cheapest form, even that point is one that doesn't have consensus among analysts, energy experts. So how do people know what information to believe and what information to reject?
I think that often what we believe comes back to our relationships with other people and our community, the people around us. A lot of what we trust is based on just who we know and who we're around. I think if people are looking for good sources of reputable information, there's lots of places that they can go. The CSIRO has lots of great resources and lots of assessments also on the cost of energy. And I think they would say that there's a pretty clear consensus that renewables are the cheapest form of new generation that we could be building right now. However, I understand it's always tricky. There's so much information out there, but I really encourage people to talk to those who have some expertise in this area. And if they've got questions, come to reputable sources, checking out some of the stuff on Community Power Agency or some of other organisations in this space.
Marie Lakey is from the Community Power Agency, and she was speaking with Angus Verley. 29 past 12. And before we get to the weather, a pastoralist in the Northern Territory has been fined almost $500,000 for stealing over 100 cattle from a neighbouring station. 74-year-old Nicholas Kostowski, who owns Neenan Station near Katherine, pleaded guilty to stealing 116 head of cattle from Man Bulu Station next door. Now, Mr. Kostowski has been ordered to pay a $430,000 fine. And it's an interesting story and worth a read online. So if you want to have a look at that, you can find the article on the ABC Rural website. You just need to search Cattle Rustling Northern Territory. That's Cattle Rustling Northern Territory. And you should find it on the ABC website there.
The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
Now, there's no news headlines today, so I'm going to dive straight into the important stuff, obviously, the weather. Joining me now is Joey Rawson from the Bureau of Meteorology to give me the latest update. Joey, let's kick things off in the north, where the Bureau has issued a cyclone warning for Darwin as tropical cyclone Fina makes its way towards the Northern Territory coast. Can you just run me through how this might impact northern Western Australia?
Yeah, no worries. So tropical cyclone Fina is now currently kind of northeast of Darwin, but it is tracking in a west-southwest direction, and it's going to potentially move near Darwin, but then move across the Joseph Bonaparte Gulf towards the North Kimberley coast, and it's expected to potentially come close or move over the North Kimberley coast Monday or Tuesday, more likely Tuesday. The good thing, Kate, is that when it gets closer to WA or the North Kimberley coast, it moves into an environment where there's a lot of dry air and a lot of conditions that are going to weaken the cyclone. So once it gets towards that kind of North Kimberley coast, it should be on a declining trend. That's the plan at this point, and that's certainly the main story for the north of WA.
Let's move down now to the Southwest Land Division. Are there more cold fronts expected in the coming days?
Yes, that's a really good question. We've got three things that are occurring over the next kind of three or so days. We've got a trough that's going to be sitting over the Southwest Land Division for tomorrow. So we're going to get showers and potentially thunderstorms through most parts of the Southwest Land Division, but it will be limited kind of south of Cunderdin and Southern Cross. The main focus where the weather will be through the Great Southern and Southwest and South Coast districts. With those thunderstorms, there is a chance of some hail and some damaging winds, especially through parts like Narrogin and Katanning and maybe Bridgetown. So, keep an eye on the warnings for that. And then that feature continues to move east, so we'll get some showers and thunderstorms through kind of the southeast coastal and the Eucla, and then it moves out of the picture by Monday and Tuesday. But following that feature, we have a front Saturday night that's going to bring showers to most of the Southwest Land Division for Sunday, and then another front just pushes more showers on Monday and Tuesday along those south coast districts. So a lot of rain and a lot of activity for this time of year, Kate.
I know. When are we going to see summer?
Well, it'll come back. By the time we get to midweek, things will certainly be settling down through the Southwest Land Division. The only thing we'll have is some light showers on the south coast and more summer conditions through those farming areas of the Great Southern and Central Wheatbelt.
Oh, my gosh. The countdown is on. Joey, thank you very much.
No worries.
Thanks, Joey. So despite that wet weather that Joey was just mentioning, fires actually got a mention in State Parliament this week. It's been 10 years since the devastating Esperance bushfires and coming up a year since a blaze ripped through the shires of West Arthur and Wagen. And this week, Member for Roe Peter Rundle asked Minister for Energy Amber Jade Sanderson if or when a report will be made public into the cause of the Great Southern Blaze.
I thank the member for Roe for some notice of the question. And first of all, I also acknowledge the 10-year anniversary since the Esperance fire and the extraordinary devastation and loss that the community experienced with that terrible event. I will say a few things about the Esperance fire and then I'll try and address your question, member. Since the Esperance fires almost 10 years ago, $9.5 million has been granted to local governments through Mitigation Activity Fund grants programs for on-ground works across the Great Southern region, and $1.15 million of this was spent with the Esperance Shire. State governments also provided the Shire of Esperance with four new light tankers in March 2022. As part of the recommendations to the coronial inquest. The Emergency Service Exposure Draft Bill is currently being prepared to consolidate and clarify existing arrangements, also in line with the coronial recommendations. Noting that these questions do not fall in my portfolio area, they actually fall in the Minister for Commerce, but I have sought an update from him and his office around the investigation. Of course, it would be inappropriate for the energy agencies to investigate themselves. So they're undertaken, it's an independent investigation undertaken by Energy Safety under the Department of Local Government, Industry, Regulation and Safety. And I also acknowledge that it was a devastating event earlier this year for the community. I'm advised by the Director of Energy Safety that there is an ongoing investigation into whether an electrical discharge was the cause of the fire. I further understand that officers from the Department of Local Government, Industry, Regulation and Safety met with Council for the Shire, met with the Council, the Shire of Wagen, in September to clarify the scope and the process of the investigation. My understanding is that by law, the department cannot publish details of the investigation, either now or at, under completion, that's a legal obligation. If a prosecution is ultimately commenced, evidence will be presented to the court in accordance with the usual rules and processes, and any civil remedies actions that may have affected property owners can proceed in the absence of any potential prosecution by the department.
Supplementary question,
thank you, Minister. Minister, how can regional communities trust that Western Power infrastructure is safe when your government won't release the findings of its own investigations?
Mr Speaker, I attempted to answer this question in good faith. As you are well aware, Western Power was not found to be the cause of the Esperance fire, so let us not connect those two issues. Well, you opened with that issue. There is a live investigation underway, and we have to allow that investigation to take course.
That was Minister for Energy Amber Jade Sanderson answering questions in Parliament yesterday from Member of Roe Peter Rundle. Well, a new survey from Meat and Livestock Australia and Australian Wool Innovation reveals a surge in producer confidence across the sheep industry. Now, according to the data, strong market prices are what's fueling optimism, with many producers planning to rebuild and expand their flocks heading into the new year. Scott Carmody is head of domestic operations at AWI. Scott, were you surprised by the results of the latest survey?
Not so surprised, but very pleased to see producer sentiment improve vastly with what it's done. It's never ever good to see producers thinking negatively about our industry, but to move to a net sentiment of plus 19, up 38 points from last year's sentiment is great, and that's over twice as many producers have that more positive outlook than a negative one. So those wool prices hitting their three-year highs, the fact that it's rained, these sort of situations are helpful in improving sentiment. So that's what we see as being the driver of this increasing sentiment and positive sentiment in regards to wool production.
So how many producers were involved in this survey and where have they come from?
It's producers were canvassed from across Australia. There was over 1,800 producers surveyed to obtain this data. There's nationally representative of, the data is nationally representative, and they'll cover most growing regions of Australia, both in the wool sector, but also the red meat sector. So it does cover a vast across Australia region.
I as you just mentioned earlier, nationally, the survey shows that wool sentiment has jumped 38 points to plus 19. How significant is this lift and how does it compare to what we've previously been seeing?
Yeah, it's significant. In a very basic sense, just looking at the data, it shows that wool growers are now positive about wool growing. They're actually turned from being against wool growing and looking at other enterprises, now switching focus back on wool growing as a viable enterprise on farm. So it is significant. And, you know, in particular with WA, with the challenges that have been faced over there, you know, 12% now believe prices will improve and keep improving, whereas that figure was 5% last year. So we're seeing a stronger interest in WA now with a 38-point lift nationally. In WA, we've lifted up to 44 points on last year. So we're seeing minus 30 sentiment last year and up to plus 14 this year. So that is significant.
Yeah, and a really quick flip in the time scheme of things, I feel.
Yeah. And once again, you know, price obviously influences that. And obviously a good look at enterprises. There was a lot of kickback across Australia last year through climate conditions and other factors that were affecting wool growing, particularly the input costs. And, you know, within our data that we've obtained out of this survey with MLA, it's showing that these input costs are expected to continue. Not many respondents were expecting that pressure on industry to alleviate to any great extent. So we're still seeing those cost pressures. But within that, we're seeing a total sentiment of believing that these wool prices can and do have the ability to improve. And that will focus back onto sheep for wool production, but also in the meat side of things as well.
But so Scott, how sustainable do you think these prices are heading into the new year?
Well, I think with the supply situation, it's commonly known, you know, the shortage of wool in the, not just Australia but across the world is probably the biggest driver at the moment. But we are seeing that uplift in demand, you know, particularly across the Northern Hemisphere, which was where most of our wool is sold, eventually sold. We're seeing an uptick in demand now. So the improving macroeconomic conditions are going to help wool sales. We are still in that luxury end of the market, that aspirational purchasing market. So we're seeing a slight uptick in there. People are willing to shop again. More of their disposable income is heading towards, you know, clothing rather than just travel and more immediate items that they're wanting to buy and to live off.
Do you think in the past, though, Scott, you've almost in a way, I don't know how to say this any other way, but shot yourself in the foot a little bit trying to target that higher end product with Australian wool?
Yeah, it's really not shooting ourselves in the foot, because really to have wool growers profitable, we need wool to sell at, you know, a luxury or a higher price, a premium price end of the market. If we had wool competing against cotton, for example, or polyester, we're taking $10 to $40 a garment off wool product, and then at that price we'd be seeing, you know, our processing division of our industry, our spinners, our weavers, they would have to pay half the price to compete against those price levels to supply those goods in store at the price the consumer wanted to pay. So no, we have to very clearly focus on wool being a premium product, and I think that's a good thing. I think it's an aspirational thing for people, consumers, to aspire to buy wool, and I think it's an aspirational thing to growers to actually produce that luxury fibre.
This is The Country Hour. You're streaming on the ABC Listen app. It is 17 to 1, and I am keen to hear from you today. If you're in the industry, what do you make about where the wool market is headed? Do text through on 0448 922 604. Scott, do you think this boost in confidence is going to influence producers' decisions when they're choosing between a meat focus versus a wool breed?
I think there's room for everything on farm, and I think the expansion of enterprise that's going to come about because of the improving wool price, you can have a meat component in that industry. Our wool industry has, and our sheep wool, they've always had a meat component. The excess stock, the young wethers getting sold off, that has always been a part of that enterprise on farm. And going forward, the improving wool price, but coupled with that very high meat price at the moment, we've quite often heard in the last couple of months that, you know, people on farm, they've never made so much money out of having, you know, sheep, particularly merino sheep on farm, you know, getting that wool income alongside that very, and we recognise that at the moment, that meat side of the equation is very much leading that, but you know, you add your fleece values on top of that enterprise and it's becoming very profitable once again.
Well, South Australia in this data is the state that has reported some of the strongest confidence levels across the country. What's driving the optimism in South Australia?
I think it's more about the seasonal conditions in South Australia. I think that's very clear. They've had a couple of very tough years, and you know, the marginal country that a lot of our wool's grown in South Australia, it's, you know, simply wool is grown in a tough environment there, and when it doesn't rain, it becomes almost impossible. So we're seeing the improved growing conditions is absolutely prime thinking that is the cause of that sentiment growth. And also that price, they're very aware of the price improvement, and particularly in the type of wool that South Australia produces. South Australia is producing very much that 18.5 through to 21 micron wool. That's the bread and butter of our industry. And they can see those solid prices there that have actually been the most consistent of any prices over the past, not just during these rises, but prior to that, prices were a bit more challenging. I think that's when those growers recognise, if I could grow more, if I can expand, I can make this work. And then you add in that meat component. So the whole enterprise is now turned that profitable corner, and the weather's been very compliant.
And what about if we jump across the border now, Scott, to here in WA? How do we compare to, say, what South Australia is sitting at?
I think it's very similar. The WA clip is surprisingly being a little bit finer. You're probably looking at about a micron, micron and a half finer than what South Australia is. So we're looking at a indicator this week of in Fremantle, you know, it closed Tuesday at 1661 on our indicator. And we, yeah, that's a sensational price. And 9.5 micron and 20 microns, yeah, they had experienced this week a $1 rise in the market. I mean, these fast rises are hard to stick. We'd understand that. But it just goes to show the extent of what the positivity around the industry is at the moment. The markets can clearly move that far in such a short period of time is indicative of not only that short supply that we're experiencing, that's acknowledged, but also that increasing demand. So the market is up nearly 33% compared to last year. So, you know, and I know one thing is, and that the calculator doesn't lie.
Well, on tomorrow's Country Hour, we will take a look at this week's wool market and what happened here in the West and over in the East. So Justin Haydock will be along tomorrow to run us through those details. Just to finish off with Scott, what does all of this signal for national supply going into 2026, do you think?
Into 26, I think we'll start to see the recovery. I truly believe that, you know, obviously the wool price improving is one factor, but the retaining of that meat value, that meat price too, would be crucial to seeing an uptick in production. And I think 2026 will be the year of consolidation and then growth into our merino sheep, but also our crossbred sheep as well. So we're going to see a sharp uptick in our production levels. I think we can react strongly if the money's there. Our landowners, they will convert some of their land use to growing sheep again.
We'll have to wait and see what happens. Scott, thank you so much for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you, Kate.
Scott Carmody is the head of domestic operations at Australian Wool Innovation. I'm not sure why I was saying tomorrow's Country Hour when the wool market is actually coming up today. It's definitely Friday here on the WA Country Hour. Well, when the southwest town of, or in the southwest of WA, I should say, faced one of its driest seasons on record in 2024, farmers battled empty dams, drying springs, and struggling livestock. Boyart Brook farmer and artist Laurie Pensini has captured that experience in her award-winning painting, Bare Earth, which featured her friend Kirsten holding an orphaned lamb over her shoulder. Laurie says the work reflects the strain on farmers and the resilience of rural communities.
So a lot of our life is working the landscape and farming the landscape. And so I basically paint from lived experience. It's not an observation for me. And coming down from the station where we were subjected to drought, that was pretty much part of mainstream life up there, we kind of thought that that wouldn't be something that we'd have to deal with down in the southwest. I mean, this is the land of milk and honey. It always rains down here. So when, we had, when the drought came through and we had some really, really challenging times when the landscape wasn't normally, it's fertile and you know, it's safe country, and we were challenged with running out of feed and running out of water. I guess you just go into survival mode, and that was, it was really powerful. It was hard to ignore. I mean, every day we got up, and it was a challenge to keep the water up. A lot of the farmers around here, a lot of my friends, you know, they had animals that were dying. The landscape was dying. Everything was suffering, you know, people, place, and planet. So it was really, it was just so hard to ignore.
Tell me about the painting. When we look at it, there's a woman standing there with a lamb over her shoulder. Tell me where that came from and the meaning behind the painting itself.
Yeah, well, that was there was a friend. We have a few friends in the region that are sheep farmers. We're cattle farmers ourselves, and it was we all got together, and we always share stories of resilience and support. I think one of the most wonderful things about being in a rural community is that we all sort of band in and help each other morally, and we were all just struggling. Everybody was in the same boat. Everybody was really fighting for just keeping things alive. So that was where it came from. I had gone out and taken some photos with Kirsten of the sheep that were that were abandoned, and she was hand feeding, which seems to be every season. There's always something that needs nurturing. And so that was, it was really powerful. It was something that I've been brought up with all my childhood. Is you always, every year you've got something that needs extra care. And it was this idea of nurturing. And it kind of went beyond just that idea of one animal and one person nurturing. It's sort of this symbol of nurturing the planet and nurturing the landscape. And we need this.
You've been here for more than 20 years now. Had you ever seen it so dry, and did it come to a shock to you guys?
Absolutely. Yeah, we chose this part. I think when we first got here, it was they said that we're one of the safest. This little land region here was one of the, Boyabrook was one of the safest rainfall areas in Australia, and there was another place over east. So we're like, oh, that was wonderful. We were weary though, coming from the having drought experience on the station, that we chose this property that had underground springs, and because that was really powerful for us. It was really important. We didn't want to go through another drought. So yeah, when this drought came, even our springs dried up. So we've said been here 20 something years, and to find that all of your dams are dry, and then your springs have shut down as well, it wasn't something that we would like to go through again.
How did the broader community challenges shape your work?
I guess it's, like I said, it's not an observation. It's everywhere you go, people are talking about it. And it's just this overarching feeling. When everything's dying around you, it's pretty hard to stay upbeat. It really brings out the true colours of your community as well. And that's what I really love about rural women and support networks, because we don't have the resources like the cities to be able to find help elsewhere. It is sort of you're banding together, I guess, because we're all sharing the same stress. We're all in the same boat, and there's a lot of strength that comes from that.
Boyabrook artist and farmer Laurie Pensini sharing her experience of the 2024 dry season with Rachel Boothman. 8-1. Well, let's stay in the southwest now, where a cherry grower is hoping the weather gods this year will bring him some prolonged sunshine as we head into cherry season in the lead up to Christmas. George Grizotis and his wife, Kathy, grow more than 12,000 cherry trees at Cherry Lane Fields in Manjimup, which is 290 kilometres south of Perth. And he says the plan is to start picking in early December. And he's got his fingers crossed that there's some more sunshine on the way to help get him there.
It's looking good. The trees are nice and healthy. You know, there's a reasonable crop. But the only thing is the weather's not in our favour at the moment because it's been cold and it's really, really slowed them down. So, you know, we're probably around about 2 weeks behind schedule at the moment. Yeah. Everything's just looking, you know, cold, as I can say. That's all I can say. It's just, I just want some, you know, a few weeks of nice, fine, sunny weather, and that should move them on, and they'll probably come on quicker, yeah. We've only had about, in the last, 2 weeks, I think we've only had about three nice, sunny days. Apart from that, it's been overcast and cloudy. Yeah, we've still got our heaters going in the house. It's that cold at night, yeah.
Can you believe it? We're almost in summer, and yet it is still so cold.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I know.
And what about all that rain, George? How have the cherries been faring with the wet weather?
It affects them when they in flower, you know, like, you know, if you get a lot of rain during flowering, you know, can they'll shed the flower or you end up getting brown rot or something like that. But at the moment, it's been really good because all the fruit's already set. It's, you know, it's probably around about fingernail size, but it's all green. And the rain now won't hurt them at all. It won't hurt them at all at this time of the year. We just don't want rain when they are ready to be picked. That's the only time that we have a problem.
So you say you're about 2 weeks behind schedule, George.
Yes, schedule, when, yeah, so.
Yeah, when are you hoping to start picking?
Well, the way things are looking, probably around about the 5th, between the 5th and the 10th of December, probably we'll start this year, yes.
That's Cherry Lane Fields co-owner George Grizzota speaking with Amelia Searson. And just a heads up, while we're on the topic of cherries and coming into Christmas, the Manjimup Cherry Harmony Festival is just around the corner, which is a family-friendly event. It's also free. That's happening on the 13th of December. So if you love cherries and you love Christmas and you want to get into the spirit, you can just head along to Manjimup on the 13th of December, where the Manjimup Cherry Harmony Festival will be taking place. 5 to 1. It's time now to check in on the wool market and just take a look at what has happened this week. Justin Haydock, can you run me through all the details, please?
We had an exceptional week in wool this week, Kate. So the AWEX EMI up 50 cents, traded at 15.14. We're up 32 cents in US terms. The Aussie dollar just back a touch. And that was down 0.33, closed at 64.91. Total offering for the week, 31,000 bales and 3.6% passed in. The Western Market Indicator closed at 16.61 and was up 76 cents for the week. 17 microns closed at 20.48 and they were up 53. 18 microns, 19.60, up 63 cents. 19 microns, 18.56, up 93 cents for the week. 20 microns, 17.98, they were up 103. While 21s, 17.89, and they were up 102 cents. So we've seen a massive gain. We did have a little bit to catch up to the east because they sold on a Wednesday the previous week and we only sold on a Tuesday. But all in all, very, very good market. For broader wools, we have actually hit a higher level than what we peaked at a month ago. And fines 18 and under, they're not too far away either. So, yeah, very, very good seller's market at the moment.
Absolutely. All I'm hearing is up, 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 up. Who was buying this week?
So major buyers for the week, Tech Wool Trading purchased 15.9%, PJ Morris 15.3%, Endeavour Wool 11.8%, Australian Merino Exports 8.5%, and the Fleece. Tech Wool Trading led the way in the crossies. Oddments, United Wool Company, 31.3%, so extremely strong there. Merino Skirtings, TNU Wool, purchased 18.4%. So with these major buyers, just looking at TNU's obviously very strong in the skirtings there, and they just missed out in the top four of the Merino Fleece, but they are a Chinese mill, and they do buy for a company, Red Sun, another big mill in China as well. So they predominantly do jump in when the market is at a lower level and buy cheaper stock, definitely helps the market along. So that was the case this week.
And are we expecting this positivity to run into next week as well?
I am. So just looking at the total offering for next week, we are at 40,000 bales, which might put just a little bit of pressure on the market. And we have seen in the past with a massive gain of, you know, 80 to 100 cents, we can lose a little bit of ground. But even if the market is off 20 to 30, that's still a 70 to 80 cent gain over the 2 weeks. And it's a very good selling market. So we're back to a Tuesday, Wednesday sale in Fremantle with 7,500 bales on offer. So a lot of this is from wool on hold, obviously a very good market this week. So a bit of wool coming off hold into the sale. So look, hopefully the market holds up. 40,000 can put a bit of pressure on, but I think we'll be okay.
All right, Justin. Well, this time next week, we'll be chatting again and see what happens.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Kate.
Justin Haydock from West Coast Wools there. Now, just before I let you go to the news at 1 o'clock, just some breaking news that's come in that the deadly bee parasite varroa mite has been detected in South Australia for the second time. Now, the Department of Primary Industries and Region says a beekeeper discovered the mite during a routine inspection of their hives at Salt Creek, which is in the Coorong region in the state's southeast. Varroa mite was actually first detected in South Australia in September in the Riverland, about 300 kilometres north of where this new find has been just today. Now, varroa mite obviously can kill honeybee colonies and transmit numerous viruses to their hosts. So that is a story that's up on the ABC Rural website now if you want to read more. It looks like the reporter is still adding to that story, so more information coming through. Anyway, that's it for the Country Hour this week. I'll be back with you on Monday. Thank you for your company. Happy National Ag Day. It's 1 o'clock. It's news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.